I think we can make it.
One more time. One last time. Okay.
If we try.
One last time. There's a lot of here. Okay. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own.
Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 338 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
And we are a bit shattered, and not because of the episode. Last minute, could not be more last minute, with a phone that's at 38%. Oh, Lord. So we have we're hoping to be able to get through this, and I think we will. Okay, so announcements?
The announcement is that next week we will be beginning our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along, and there are still chapters up for grabs. Go to www.outlanderpod.com/snow to find out more information.
So this episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Aaron A. And we will mention at the end how you can find out more about supporting us on Patreon and how you too, if you like, can become a co-producer.
And now on to our discussion of episode 512, the season finale of season 5, entitled Never My Love. And you know, when I first saw that title, I was like, I don't think that's anything in the book. And I was like, and I just kept hearing that 60s song, Never My Love. And I was like, I wonder if it's that. And I'm pretty positive they have now officially ruined that song for me. I still like the song.
So this was the shortest episode of the season, if I'm not mistaken. And while also, I believe, probably the most difficult subject matter of the season, I think I first wrote this, and now that all this, I should never write this again because this is what happened. Summer and I spent probably what time is it? We probably spent, oh Lord, almost a half an hour troubleshooting. Yeah. Or I spent half an hour troubleshooting, but we finally got our stuff together. And, but let me read you what I wrote as I started taking my notes. Now this is the shortest episode of the season. And I think while one of the most difficult in subject matter, I think also might be one of our quickest episode discussions. Content wise, I don't know, but definitely not setting up wise, darn it.
I feel like before we get started, we need to address the elephant in the room. The elephant being Outlander's latest fake out.
Oh, the time travel stuff?
Yeah. So I was very vocal last week about how that was a terrible decision. And knowing full well that it could absolutely end up being a fake out, because this is not the first time Outlander has faked us out. Even back in season one.
Wasn't the only one to guess it, because I know a lot of people were saying, you know, we're wondering what happened. We were all wondering. But yeah, we were both tweaked about it. But I was I was hopeful.
It was the implication of what it could mean.
Oh, Lord, I know.
Now, while the way that they brought it back is fine. Like, we're back. We're not that far off track from where we need to be story-wise, that we can still stick to actual plot, right? But we're also now down 3 gemstones.
Oh, yeah.
Which could be a problem later.
Okay, so let's get to this episode, and we'll talk more about that stuff because, well, we've kind of talked about it now, but there's a little bit more to say about the actual TT at that point. So this episode, at first I thought, this is going to be the longest cold open ever. No, there was no open. It just opened, or it was a cold open, but there was no intro.
I was afraid, they were showing last week's recap, right?
Yeah.
And I was afraid that the audio wasn't working, because all I could hear was music. And I was like, I can't hear any of the dialogue. Is it broken? I'm like, I can't watch a whole episode like this. And then they got to, yeah, and then we were good.
But I thought it was pretty fitting. And even though it was obviously for the sake of the viewer to bring them back, but it also definitely could have been Claire's mind, right? It's going through not just what she's going through, bringing us up to date. She doesn't need to be brought up to date. She knows what the heck happened. But It's everything in her mind. It's all the things connecting from their first meeting with the Browns, or from them coming for the to do the committee of safety, the broken syringe, him finding the doctor's medicine box by Dr. Rawlings, like him putting that together. So it's all these snippets that serves a number of purposes. One, for the viewer to say, okay, just don't forget it. Like, this has been linked pretty early in the season, but it also neatly fit. Could be seen as fitting Claire, like all of these pieces of her, of memory or of, you know, of the past coming together. It's like, oh my God, like all these things. And this is like, this is why, right? All those things have culminated in this. And it goes, as Summer said, all she heard was music. And it links us straight in from the last episode and picks up with Claire in the 1960s. With the song Never My Love by The Association. And I'll share a link in the show notes. Now, I thought before we go on further in the episode, because I know we're still at the top, all I kept hearing, and I know they played the song, all I kept hearing was Never My Love, Never My Love. I didn't know if I could actually like recite or sing the rest of the lyrics. So I looked them up, and it was very fitting, because when you just hear, at least when I didn't know the song very well. I've heard of it, right? I knew Never My Love, that's it. But I didn't know the rest of the lyrics. I could never have told you what they were. But I didn't quite understand Never My Love. Like, how, why is that even linkable? Until you read the rest of the lyrics. And in brief, it's, you ask me if there'll come a time when I grow tired of you, never my love. You wonder if this heart of mine will lose its desire for you, never my love. What makes you think love will end? When you know that my whole life depends on you, never my love. And you say you fear I'll change my mind and I won't require you, never my love. How can you think that love will end when I've asked you to spend your whole life with me? So that makes a lot more sense than never my love. Did you know the song?
Clearly, I knew the song way better than you, because I knew exactly what it meant when it started playing. Yes, you did.
Well, I knew the song when it started playing.
And I did immediately look it up, because I was like, I said, wait, does this, I said, this was a 60s song. I hope, is it 60s before she goes back? And it's 1967, so it works. It's a great song. I love that song. But again, might be positively ruined by this episode.
Oh, gosh. Well, so the first time I watched it, I didn't take notes. I was going to, but I didn't. And I just watched it for what it was. I watched it for the experience. I was thankfully able to do that. The second time I had to put my thoughts down. I thought, okay, so I'm working this out in my brain, and no, I'm not stupid or dense. I'm just like, okay, so what might this be? So this, if I'm not mistaken, this is her, the 60s time, right? Is her semi dissociation from her present as she imagines all those she loves as her mind dissociates from what's happening. Is that correct?
I called it her happy place, like her mind palace, like the place she goes to.
I think that they're both absolutely valid.
Yeah. And for what it's worth, I would watch hours and hours and hours of Outlander in the 60s if everyone was in it.
Oh my gosh.
Coloring, the music, everything about it. I loved it.
I have so many questions. I have more questions about, I think, because again, it's not in the book. I have so many questions about the 60s part of this, not necessarily the time period, but what happened and the theme and the colors and who was there and who wasn't there and what they were doing and all of that. And the day and the night and the rain and the dripping, all that. I have so many questions, so many more questions about the 60s than I do the rest of the episode. It's kind of pathetic. So why do you think?
I think that the dripping from the ceiling is reality trying to break in. Like she's found a way to like heavily meditate and get into this like mental place. And that little drip, drip, drip is reality trying to get her out of it. Like there's something wrong with this. This isn't real.
That's what I thought. When I first thought, I was like, huh. And then the only time I put that together or went that step further was when I realized, because I didn't try to think about it on the first watch. I just tried to experience it. But on the second watch, I was noticing that the 60s portion goes from bright heck of daylight to bright sun, grass, or scenery, as well as a lot of wood, bright, bright wood inside, to different time in the 60s where it's dark and stormy. So to me, it was when it was dark and stormy, when her, when the reality, her present, right, her, with the gang was pulling her away. Either she wasn't able to sustain her happy place or her reality was, you know, seeping in. And absolutely, that's what I thought.
She couldn't keep Lionel out of it.
Oh, well, yeah, but it wasn't just Lionel.
She couldn't.
Well, I mean, yeah. Absolutely.
No, but he was present almost every time it got
dark. When
it got
dark, yes. But when she saw the dripping ceiling, though, I don't think he was there. He may have come in the next scene.
No, not the dripping
ceiling.
But
yeah, so Lionel, absolutely, she couldn't keep him out. But it was, yeah, so it was her happy place is the 60s, surrounded by her family, right? And beautiful, bright colors, her true time, and bright sunniness at a Thanksgiving meal, right? Preparing for Thanksgiving. So I know it doesn't happen yet. We can come back to it if you want, but I did write this at the top. Why do you think her mind, it seemed to me, like I said, I have a lot more questions about the 60s than I do the rest of the episode. It seemed to me, well, number one, she didn't say a word or make a sound until the doorbell rang and she opened the door to the cops, right? That's the only time she started saying anything in the 60s. She kept her mouth shut. She just wasn't talking. Everyone else around her was talking and enjoying and eating and everything. She didn't eat. She didn't do much. And it seemed like they
have established the 60s as a safe place. So her happy place is a safe place that's not in her mind's eye about to go into a revolution, right? The Revolutionary War. And all of her people are there with her. So she can keep them all safe too.
Well, not just about the war, but she's also, it's also out absent of all the abduction.
No. I'm not saying it's about the war. What I'm saying is the 60s is their safe place. Everyone talks about how much safer it is to be in the 60s. So she's imagined this place where all of her people are safe.
Oh,
and they're all with her and they're all together. Kiva. And even in that safety, bad things are happening because Bree and...
Yes. Okay. So then why do you think... I guess I have an idea. So when everyone showed up, basically everyone and their dog, I mean, literally everyone except Rollo showed up and they were all seated at the table and everyone was eating, but Claire and they kept going to the two empty seats, right? Obviously that was Roger and Bree. And then when the cops came, the doorbell rang, they're like, I'm sorry. And that was the first time she opened her mouth in the 60s. Or in her happy place. Why do you think they chose not to have Roger and Bree in her happy place or have her killed, them killed?
I think that was just like a manifestation of even her happy place is not perfect, right? And not only that, but you have to think of all of the people in her happy place are currently, well, with the exception of Myrta, who is Deed, are currently in the 1700s with her, and they're all in one place. So Roger and Bree and Jemmy are no longer, as far as she knows, a part of her storyline. So for them to, they are out of reach. They are not able to be a part of her happy place. And she's I think, also riding the fear of what happened. What happened to them? Are they safe? I can't protect them anymore.
So something else I thought of, besides it being, I agree with you, her happy
and
place.
Frank died in a car, by the
way. Yeah, well, by the way, like, I don't know that. But yeah, I agree with you. Something else I thought about was, obviously, I didn't say a happy place. You did. I agree with you. I think there are many ways many ways to address it or to, what to call any names for it. It was absolutely her happy place. So whether it was her mind created this so she could dissociate from what was happening to her, because hello, who wouldn't? Or it was her happy place that she, whether it was, however it happened, right? Whether it was on purpose, her mind just created it like automatically, or she's like, I can't do this. I gotta be somewhere. So either way, I think it could be dissociation, but absolutely. You know, you don't have to dissociate from your body or from your mind to have a happy place, right? They talk about that a lot in yoga or meditation. So either way.
It's just like focus, like finding
your zen, finding your happy. So one of the things that I thought of was, okay, you say happy place, right? And I don't disagree. I think that's a very good term for it or description for it. When I was writing it down, I wrote it was a happy place she went to, but it was the scene or the scenario or the place, whatever, of her dissociation, semi-dissociation. That's what I kept calling it. But what I also called it or addressed it as later on in my notes was, I wouldn't go so far as to say heaven, but I did liken it to something like that. So she, I believe, well, she tells the others, you know, if you touch me, you're going to die, because she does know if Jamie makes it, they're all dead. But she also doesn't know for sure. I think she has faith, but she doesn't know for sure if he will make it in time, right? Because she's been mishandled and mistreated a lot. And so even though I don't think she's like literally on death's door, like about to have her last breath, I think she has been more and more and more and more mistreated and manhandled and kicked and abused, that she goes, whereas her dissociation or her happy place is first to be able to, you know, escape this, right? Escape it in the moment. I think she keeps going back more easily until someone like Lionel comes and she's, you know, pulled out by something, by a number of things. But I think it starts as a coping mechanism. Absolutely. I think the more it went on, I was thinking this is almost her version. And maybe that's what a happy place is, almost her version of heaven in a way. And the reason I thought about that is because when Roger and Bree are not there, everyone else, let's think about the 60s, right? Forget about people in the 18th century, although they're all there. That is her family. They're around the Thanksgiving table, right? Everyone is there except Roger and Bree. Mm-hmm. So take the time travel part out of it. The reason I thought it, you know, the thought of heaven or afterlife came to my mind was because literally everyone,
because she has to wait
in the 60s, everyone who was there besides her is dead, right? In the 1960s. And she, if this is her heaven and she's exactly trying to imagine this happy place, well, you know, this is happening to me, but at least, you know, I can imagine that when I pass over, when I cross over, I will be with my people. I will be with my family, and it'll be in her happy place surrounded by those that she loves. And yes, they're all dead in the 1960s. And so I thought them in that frame, it made sense that they weren't there because they were not of the 18th century. And so, and thus not automatically dead just because they weren't born then. But it leaves, I think, some room for thought. It just leaves some room for thought. I may be looking too deeply into that. I think there are a number of ways to look at it. But it also echoes or mirrors the fact that, exactly what you said, right? Like they could be lost to her. They were lost in time because they were supposed to have gone through the stones. And as far as she knows, they were. So it makes sense that she wouldn't see them or wouldn't maybe not know where they are. What was an odd choice, although maybe not odd, an interesting choice was them saying that they died in a car accident. Because absolutely, because Frank died in a car accident in the 60s. So maybe her, I don't know why, it makes sense why her mind would use a car crash, because that is, in the 60s, how she lost someone she loved, a modern person, right? Frank was modern. Bree, although she's the 200-year-old baby, Bree and Roger are also modern. So it made sense that they would have, maybe make sense that they would have perished in a way that more than just Frank, like her parents also died in a car crash. So there's the reason, or I should say the way that they died, makes sense for Claire, or for it coming from her brain, right? From her mind. To me, that makes sense. Why they chose to say that they were dead, the means of death makes sense. I don't think that's much of a reach or too hard to think about. I still don't necessarily understand why they were quote unquote killed / not at the Thanksgiving table. Again, unless you're looking at a little bit like the afterlife and that's telling us that they weren't dead. Anyway, that's a lot and we have barely started. So we start with the 60s setting. Now, is this arranged? Is this just a again, I can go with Claire's Happy Place. Is it supposed to be a 60s version, not of the 18th century literal big house, but a 60s version of a big house? Because it looked huge from the views they were giving on the outside, surrounded with all this greenery.
I'm sure. And then she also had the giant finger painting of the house on the ridge.
Oh, see, I missed that. I saw the painting. I saw the painting.
You missed that?
I saw the painting.
You didn't know it was the ridge?
No, I did not.
Yeah, it was the big house.
Well, then, okay, so that must have been... I must have been decently close. And we see Claire from the back looking at a piece of abstract art, where I thought it was abstract. Apparently it was a big house. And the camera focuses on an orange. What was the orange?
The only thing that I could take from the orange is that she thought about it again later when she saw Lionel in the surgery, and she decided not to do whatever she was considering doing with the scalpel. And she was thinking about the orange. And the only thing that I remembered about the orange is that they practice sutures on oranges.
I was about to say, they do. Yes. Okay. They practice sticky needles. Okay. So maybe I think that's, to me, that would be the only thing that made sense too. And they show us a blue vase. So of course that's a tie back to season one, episode one, where she has always wanted a place to call home so that she could have a place to keep something like a vase. And it's also a callback to, I don't know which episode, but also season one, where she had a vase with flowers, right? They brought that in on the episode that had quarter day in it when they were at Lallybroch. So this is definitely blue vase is definitely reflective of her heaven, of her home, of her happy place. And then we flash back to her being tied up and gagged. And then we go to the house. This is back in the 60s. And there is, we see a table setting. There's going to be a dinner party at first we see. And I wrote, I wonder, again, this is before I went, really thought hard about it, but I wonder if her mind is separating, preparing not just to escape from the present, but also preparing her for death. Just because she's suffering more and more and more. Again, those are my early thoughts.
Did you notice that in...
when her family arrives
that in the 60s, everyone was in 60s period clothing except really Jamie? Like the jacket, like the overcoat he wears was definitely like a 60s kind of a leather jacket. But the shirt and the pants, he looked a lot like season one hair Jamie.
So when her family arrives for dinner, actually my early on, again, second watching, but so the question reflects the chronology of the episode, but I had already seen it, so I already knew what was going to happen. But I wrote, with this empty table that's being set, right, before Jamie arrives, before we see him, I thought, I wonder when her family arrives for dinner, and this kind of maybe answers my question I had earlier, when everyone arrives for dinner, it'll be complete. Does that mean her happy place and thus her life and her time on this earth is complete? And maybe... when Roger and Bree don't come, whatever the reason was given, it's not complete. It's not going to happen. She's not going to die. So I had that thought as well.
You gave that way more thought. The only time I was really concerned for her was when she started seeing rabbits.
Oh, yeah. We'll get there too. Okay. So after I had that, I said, is that supposed to be Jamie in the Hay, Jamie? Mm-hmm. Because the hair is... interesting, but the hair was like almost like they were trying to make it Jamie in the Hay, Jamie, but it didn't look as good as that, even though that hair, people had issues with the hair. I thought the hair was kind of like tumbled and sexy, but this hair just looked like raggedy 60s hair. You know what I mean? It almost looked like 60s rough hair.
It was like Beatles hair.
Yes. Yes.
Like long Beatles
hair. And so it did not look like Jamie in the Hay hair, except that's the only thing we have that's closest to that. But yes, definitely 60s. That's
no,
a good
but
way.
It did look a lot like season one.
It did.
It looked a lot like season one Jamie hair. Much closer to that than we have now.
And it looked like he was wearing a shirt. I mean, he had a shirt on. I mean, like an 18th century shirt or a play on it. A 1960s play on an 18th century shirt, right? The one that goes down to your knees or whatever. And it looked like he had 60s inspired, not quite fully in the 60s, but 60s inspired or 18th century inspired modern navy slacks. And they fit well, but it wasn't that Jamie was in a different outfit that it looked odd. It was that they didn't commit. Everyone else was full on committed 60s outfit. Jamie was like in between, you know what I mean? And maybe that's a function of her. Like, she can't get him fully out of his place in time, even though she brings him forward. Mm. Maybe. You said something about the leather jacket, and I agree. I think that was pretty 60s, but it also is not taking Jamie much out of the 18th century because he had a leather jacket, his dad's leather jacket. I thought that was very, very much in keeping with Jamie.
A lot of stuff happened. For instance, Claire still has no concept of self-preservation.
Come on, Summer. You've read 8 books.
Don't let her curse you. And then she immediately is out like, don't you touch me again or you'll all be dead by dawn. I'm like, come on. It leads to no good thing. And then she immediately tries to scare superstitious people into helping her, which almost never really works.
Yeah. And she's
like, she has no new methods.
Agreed. Since season one, although season one is a lot more understanding because she just fell through. It wasn't her fault. She didn't know what happened and she didn't want to be there. Claire's present is the episode, the first half of the episode, I guess, or at least when we're with Claire, because time does pass. But Claire's present time is what we see at the beginning of the episode. It's dark and she's tied up and beaten already. It is, I think, before she is raped, although who knows if something happened even before that. We don't know. It doesn't really matter. She's violated enough. But her present is, it's dark. She's tied up. Because everything else, whether it's going back to how she was abducted or them talking about crossing the river or her, like you just said, talking about how she curses people and she doesn't learn, or them saying she's sitting next to the fire and she looks at him and he's like, don't have look at me. Take her somewhere else so she can. That's before it's still daylight outside.
Yeah. And then he like punches her in the face while she's gagged. So then her nose is all swollen and then she almost suffocates through her swollen up nose. And that's when she starts to see rabbits. And that's when we get a little bit more information about Wendigo Donner.
So one of the things that was interesting is that the show, because they went forward into book 6, right? If you haven't read book 6, sorry, we did not spoil you. The show did. It's just the way it is.
Join us next week when we will be discussing book 6.
Well, come on. Chapter 1. We're not going that far. But the reason I say this is because one of the differences, and I don't think it's a spoiler. I don't think it's an extra spoiler. But one of the differences between what they did, not just by bringing it up, by bringing it forward, but one of the differences is that when they, right, shortly after they abducted her, they said, we're going to take you to Brownsville and we're going to show everyone who you are and what you, I'm going to tell them what you said and what you did. In the book, it was Lionel and a gang, but it was a traveling gang that is alluded to in many other ways, which I will not spoil. And Lionel was part of it, and Wendigo Donner and Hodgepodge were all part of it. I think it's probably the same gang, but it was different. It wasn't intended to take her to Brownsville and find justice at all. It was to harass
her. They were not moving forward, really. They were just trying to complete that portion of the Brown
production
story.
I agree with you. I'm just saying they could have done the exact same thing, like not changed like any of the storyline or what happened in the episode, and just left out Brown, actually, not even Brownsville. I take it back. In the book, it wasn't Brownsville, but there is a time. Well, yeah, okay. I can't say much more without spoiling it. But anyway, that wasn't their intent when they abducted her at this point. Okay. One thing we didn't say, although we don't have to talk a lot about it, is I thought it was very, it was shocking at first. And then I realized, she's placing it in her time where it fits the most sense. This is why I kept saying dissociate, but happy place makes sense too. When young Ian shows up, because it was doorbell, 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 and people kept arriving and young Ian shows up fresh from the army. that was a little surprising.
Right. Not really. That's what he would do if he was in the 60s.
That's true. Oh, well, I thought it would have been his he's male and his age. He would have been fighting a war. But it's not just his male, his age. It's who he is now, right? He is a warrior now. He's a Mohawk warrior now. So that makes sense.
As evidenced by his future tomahawk work in the fight scene.
So when Claire tried to escape and they got her back, you know, they like, that was not from the book. That was interesting. They like cut her chest. And when she's being abused and cut and held and tied up, the camera does, you don't know to look for it because you don't know who he is yet. But once you know, and you watch on a rewatch, look at whenever the camera goes to Wendigo Donner, he at this point, he doesn't know her full story or how much he's going
to
find out.
In his first scene talking to her, he's like, where are you from? Where do you come from? Like before this.
Yes, but this is before that. This is when they're still with the gang and they haven't made camp yet. They're terrorizing her, tying her up, all these things. And the camera goes to him and he looks unsure, like,
He explains that later in his parting shot to her. He says, you don't act afraid of men. You ought to act more afraid. That's what tipped him off.
Was he already tipped off by that? Absolutely. I don't think that's why the camera stayed on him. I think the camera stayed on him, or what was being shown by his face was, could have been surprise. Yeah, okay, maybe like you're saying, like, you know, this is odd. Like, she's not acting like a normal woman at this time would, even if he didn't verbalize it or sub-verbalize it to himself in those words. Absolutely. But he could have had that thought and had that, you know, or be thinking those thoughts without the camera being on him. So obviously the camera, when you go back and watch it a second or third time, you'll notice that he makes certain faces with the camera on him that you may have not caught the first time, if you guys didn't catch it. And then Tebby, they're in a wagon too, a covered wagon. Tebby tries to warn them, Tebby tries to warn the men that she's dangerous, she's a conjure woman, and then she curses them. And then Wendigo asks her where she came from, and he has a modern general American accent. So there you go. And this is when they've made camp and she's tied up, but she's not like beaten. It's not dark yet. And he says something like the man on the moon. And when he says that, yeah, she like looks at him so quickly. She immediately looks at him. And one of the things that also happens in the 60s, besides the where and the what and how it looks and who's there, is that the times where she's looking off into the distance or into the glass walls, I guess, is Jamie brings a blanket to put around her. And the first time we see it, I don't know what it looks like, but it's a blanket. And later on, when we see it, her in the 60s, it's his tartan.
I remembered plaid the whole time.
So this is the first time, and that the rabbit had not happened yet, but it was because of the rabbit on the first watch that on the second watch I was able to write this. So she's doing, her mind is doing what Jamie's did at Culloden. Now, Jamie, I think, was a lot closer to the actual death as far as his injury was concerned and bleeding out. But they both are, their minds are going to a type of happy place or dissociating to deal with what's going on, because they can't deal, honestly. So I just wrote, this is, she's doing what her mind is doing for her, what Jamie's mind went through at Culloden. And he says to her in her happy place, you're shaking so hard, it's making my teeth rattle. So she's even making him physically feel more real in her. So she's feeling this, and it's her image of him, her ghost of him is reacting to her physical shaking, her physical shivering. That Tebby was kind to her. This is when they're in the wagon.
He was kind to her with a purpose. He's like, tell your spirits.
So he wouldn't get cursed.
Tell your spirits. No, I'm a good man. I did my best. I was taking care of you.
But I think they didn't actually do it, but I think he would have tried to let her go like they talked about. He agreed to it until Hodgepile came over. Lionel. I think it was Hodgepile.
I'm glad Hodgepile didn't get a bigger part. I don't care for how long he stuck around in the books.
That was a bit much, yeah.
And I'm happy we didn't have to spend as much time with him as we did with Bonnet.
I think we all have an example or can find an example of a small change that we've made that's turned into a longer lived lifestyle change. I know since I've been working at home from home now, more recently, I've been much more on top of the dishes, and I've gotten to the point where rather than making the sink kind of the wayload, the parking zone, I'm pretty good now at putting things straight in the dishwasher. So it's become a more consistent habit. I'll say that.
I would say that I have been consistently getting up later than I used to since I live at home now and I work at home. And that was a real easy change for me.
In life, making small changes to everyday life can lead to positive lifestyle changes. The right towel turns a bathroom into a spa. just like the right loungewear turns function into luxury.
You know Brooklinen as the internet's favorite sheets, but they're also home to bedding, loungewear, towels, and more with over 50,000 five-star reviews and counting. You know, some of what I love the most about Brooklinen products is just how easily they can fit into your already existing lifestyle. Because with the multitude of highly coordinatable prints and colors.
And one of those five-star reviews is definitely from me. I love my white sheets that I got from Brooklinen. It is a whole set. It's a duvet cover and top sheet, fitted sheet, and pillow covers. It is not only comfortable and luxurious feeling, it is also very practical. You may think, why white, Ginger? Well, because that's kind of my bedroom neutral. So it goes with anything else I get. My other duvet covers, my other sheet sets, it all works together.
And they come in more than just white. The set that I went with is a thin gray and white stripe. With the coordinating patterns and colors that are available with Brooklinen, they easily integrate within your space, adding the luxury feel without completely having to change the look of your style. Well, I personally have been quarantined away from my Brooklinen sheets, and I miss sliding into those buttery sheets at night.
As Summer said, one of the best thing about my Brooklinen sheets is that not only do they fit into my pre-existing decor with the decoration, the furniture, all of that, color-wise, because I picked it that way, the look and feel is so luxurious. It's like it is like sleeping on something that feels so silky. And it has helped bring a feeling of luxury into my bedroom space. And, you know, it makes me want to kind of bring the rest of my bedroom space, but, you know, little bits of the rest of my apartment, kind of up to that little bit more standard of luxury.
Founded in early 2014 by husband and wife duo Rich and Vicky Phillip, they wanted to find beautiful home essentials that didn't cost an arm and a leg. Today, they are on a mission to make you comfortable.
They've moved beyond the bedroom to offer bathroom and life essentials. Towels, super plush, ultralight, hammam, melange color block, shower curtains, bath mats, robes, and candles to add that extra lavish touch, and even ultra-soft loungewear, making you feel like you never left bed.
Brooklinen.com is the perfect place to start making small changes that make big differences. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, loungewear, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. Go on, make yourself comfortable. Get 10% off your first order and free shipping when you use promo code Outlander at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code Outlander.
Brooklinen, everything you need to live your most comfortable life. So they're going to cross the river. They don't show it, which is, you know, not a big deal. And then in the 60s, we see Murta. I'm like, and this is the first time I'm like, dang, this is like literally everyone, even Jocasta. And then we're back in her present, and Windigo Donner hears her say, Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ. And that's when he's like, he's sold. He's like, no. This is not a rando person or a rando woman. Okay, and then we go back to the 60s. Jamie's wrapping her in a tart. Now I see the Outlander tartan, although it could have been that all along. And then, okay, this is before she's tied up. She's tied up, but not gagged. She's gagged, but not tied up to a tree yet.
She doesn't have the noose around her neck.
Yes. So she stares at Lionel, and I was like, take her somewhere so I had to look at her. And that's when they take her to the tree. And then, still in the 60s, Claire continues not to talk, and she's not even eating. And again, the stuff that she does or doesn't do is reflective of what she does or doesn't do in her present. As far as, you know, she's not talking, she's not eating, obviously. She's offered food that one time. But she's just waiting. She's just being. And then in her present, this is what, as Summer said, this is where she sees, well, it starts in her present. And then we see a rabbit on an orange shag carpet. Uh-huh. So that's definitely in her happy place. But then when they go away from it,
it's still there.
It's on the forest floor. So it's in both places. And again, definitely a tie-in to episode 301 when Jamie was dying on the field of Culloden. And rabbits, again, symbolize abundance, wealth, prosperity, fertility, longevity.
And
then the scene turns into the forest floor.
Just kidding.
And rabbits signify death? Summer. Stop it.
In an Outlander, at least.
Oh, gracious. So Wendigo saves her from choking because she's trying to move up and, like, try to make enough room in her mouth to get air through her gag. And he basically ungags her, removes the gag for long enough so that they can chat. And he says it to me. Like, I knew it when she responded or when he said it the second time. But the first time on the rewatch, I was like, what the heck is he saying?
You didn't understand Ringo Starr? Does the name Ringo Starr mean anything to you?
It did the first time when I was taking notes. I was like, what the hell is he saying? And then when he asked the second time, I did. But on the second watch, I was like, I knew what he asked her, but I was taking notes. My mind was on what it was writing, and I was like, what did he say? Yeah. Does the name Ringo Starr mean anything to you? And she said, yup. And he's officially outed as a TT. So now you guys know why it's so exciting to have Wendigo Donner here. We get a teensy weensy bit of his backstory. And to be fair, in the book, at this point, we don't get much either. It's about this much. He traveled with other Native Americans, including Robert Springer, or Ottertooth. And Claire tells him that he died. He was killed by the Mohawk. He says he won't untie her, but he does say that later on, when it's quiet, he'll take her and they can escape. And he's like, I need to go back. I've tried for so long. I need gemstones. And she's like, look, I have stones. I can show you some traveling stones too. I can get you to a circle. You just need to get me out of here. So I do believe
I don't think so, because he immediately then said, I can't help you because I need to go home.
He needs to go home, as in get back to the 20th
century.
I
know. And he's saying he can't help her now because his focus is getting home and not on the minutiae of day-to-day life in this time.
But that's why she says, I can get you home. I can get you stones and show you even where a stone circle is.
He has been trying so long. I can get you stoned.
No.
I mean, he was from the 60s.
Oh, my goodness. Well, okay. The way I understood it was, he wasn't going to help her. He's like, no, you don't understand. I got to do this. And he's like, I need gemstones. And she says, I can get you stones. I could even take you to a ding dong stone circle. And the way I understood it was that he said, once it's quiet and the camp is not so lively and people are asleep, I will come and get you. But as she tells Jamie later, he didn't hurt me, but he didn't help me, because they never got to the point where he could have come back. And this is the first time, I'm not saying she didn't think about him, but this is the first time I wrote, when we go back to her happy place in the 60s, when she's staring out at the void and Jamie's wrapping her in a tartan, she's feeling, you know, she feels in her mind, she wants to feel safe. Jamie is her home, right? Jamie is home. Lionel, his face bleeds into her sight. Mm. And this is, who knows how many, and this, I wrote this, this sounds really crass, but who knows how many rapes, right? They only showed two.
But yeah, but then they showed everyone starting to line up.
Lining up, exactly. Sorry, you're right. So during a rape, during one of her violations, she absolutely continues to dissociate and imagines her house guests play hitting each other with couch cushions while Jamie holds her. So she's enveloping herself in Jamie as home to further insulate herself and dissociate from what's going on in her present. But it's only when she is going through her rapes, if I'm not mistaken, that her house guests are playing kind of mock fisticuffs, like hitting each other with couch cushions. At first I thought it was, even though it was play and they were very soft, it was kind of a way for what was happening in her present to bleed over into her happy place, like, unfortunately. Or was it just family fun time to distract her? I don't know. What did you think that was?
I don't recall the pillow fight you're speaking of. I'll have to go back,
gracious,
and rewatch.
It's more than once. You have to watch it, girl. I can't believe you didn't see that. Murtaugh, like, hits one of the kids with...
was getting tired of her 60s flashbacks. As much as I would love to watch an entire show of that, I'm like, when is she going to just get rescued already?
Not back
How
and
much
forth?
Longer are we going to keep doing this? Because I'm done.
That's true. That's funny. So then she... Okay, so, and this is why I thought it was, I don't know. I see it both ways, either to distract her from what was going on or to be a manifestation of like the most violent thing that's happening in our happy place is people hitting each other with cushions, okay? But as Lionel slaps her, we go straight to her happy place and see Marsley with her baby. When she's slapped again, the camera has someone in the 60s playing with a toy dragonfly. So that's another hint
that was,
to the books.
That was probably Germa.
Yeah. And then more horseplay. So it was like every time she was, not every time, but during this scene with Lionel, it was a lot of back and forth. And all of this is happening while, at least in her happy place, Jamie is holding her. So while this is happening with Lionel, she focuses on the blue vase. And then it's again daylight. So this to me means that Lionel, she's successfully dissociating because there's no more darkness and there's no more Lionel and it's daylight again. And Jamie is bringing in drinks and it's gone back to the beginning. He says the table looks ready. And is this her, this is what I wrote, is this her subconscious saying she's ready to go? I don't know. He says, I checked on the turkey. So that's another confirmation that it's Thanksgiving. Also, her color, I didn't think about it until this point. She's in red. Everyone else is in much more, even though it's definitely 60s clothing, she's the only one in this bright color. And I don't know if it's a favorite color or if it's like a scarlet red because she's, you know, beaten and bloody right now. I don't know. Again, Roger and Bree are still missing, all of that. When Lionel leaves her and two more men approach in her present, again, as you said, they were kind of lining up. So we go back to her present when Lionel leaves, more men line up, and then she's back to her happy place in daylight. I'm sure Roger and Bree will be here soon. And then nighttime appears again. Cops come. Roger and Bree are dead. The first word she speaks finally in her happy place is yes when she opens the door and then oh. And then everything comes crashing in. The white light, she kind of backs up and kind of like the musical, if you've seen it, Les Mis, she lines up with the other ghosts. So basically, do you hear the people sing when they're all dead? We finally get the answer. I'll let Summer say it because she's been so patient. We finally get the answer to what happened with Bree and Jem and Roger.
Well, the Mackenzies wake up at the Stones and little Jemmy goes waving off and running off. And luckily, he didn't just run into the street because there was no Tufty to warn him about cars. And instead, it was young Ian sitting on the stone. Luckily, still there with the wagon so they can get home. But I had a problem with
thank goodness
the potential continuity of this moment because this did not occur concurrently with Claire's defiling by the Brownsville because the journey from the Stones back to the Ridge is a 2-week journey. So in... It's not this episode timeline. The Bree and Roger's timeline is not in sync with Claire and everyone else's timeline until about halfway through the episode. Because I was like, if they just came through the Stones.
I may have to let this go. But before she was the night before she was abducted, Jamie and Claire, after Bree and Jem and all them have left with Ian, right? In episode 5:11. The night before she's abducted. Or some evening before she's abducted. Could be a day, could be a week. She's looking at the sketches of, I think it's Jem, and she's there with Jamie, right? And she's thinking of how much she misses them and everything. We learn at that point that they have a conversation that it's about 2 weeks to the Stones. That's how we get the 2-week time frame. And the episode ends with them going through and then waking up and all that. So if it takes 2 weeks to get there... And it takes 2 weeks to get back. And this is where I think I just had to let it go, but it's kind of breaking my head right now. So basically, by the time Claire, okay, forget this episode. Let's think about last episode. But the time Claire is abducted, as long as it's the next day, right? Because she's abducted. Jamie goes out to the still, comes back, lights the cross. The next day, they're out looking for her, right? So that happens super fast.
Right.
It has to be almost a
Which
month.
Is my point.
Between them leaving and them coming back, which means she's abducted approximately a month after they leave.
Yeah, but that's my point. They're not, the two storylines are not happening at the same time. They're not concurrent. That's all I was saying. Either that or they traveled with the wind at their backs and it got them home a lot faster than it took them to get to the Stones.
Yeah, fair enough. That's a lot more common on the water, but yes. So as they see Ian and they're like, we don't know what happened. Their love theme plays as she says, "I was thinking of home."
We know that they were gone.
Yes, because Ian saw them.
Because he saw them go. And then we know that they were back because all of the stones were gone. And then they just said, what were you thinking of? And everyone would say they were thinking of home. And I'm like, I guess the ridge is home.
Then we go to the ridge. On the way to the ridge, they see the burning cross. And Roger and Ian are, this is how obviously Roger and Ian are able to join Jamie et al. To find Claire. And so they get there. I love how Ian is making himself up. He like smears, I think it's blood. He puts it all over his, it's either that or dye, but I don't know where he finds dye. He paints himself red.
I said, Ian prepares a bloody show. And freshly shaved summer.
In the 60s, it's daylight again. Jamie arrives and she's back looking at the art. And they dance in semi-darkness. He holds her and then she's back to her present. And at this point, there are gunshots all around. Jamie is here.
I am so glad we didn't have to watch them look for them. I'm so glad we cut straight to the rescue because I could not watch one more moment of Claire being raped, beaten, gagged,
or in the 60s. Abused.
Choose your adjective. I had had enough.
Yeah, I hear you.
It was enough. We get it.
We do get it.
We get it. It was awful. They did horrible things to her.
So the battle goes on and Claire is back in the 60s. Claire, she's a staring Claire, Jamie reaching out to touch her face. And in this scene, when we look at them, this is the first time I didn't see it the first way through. I only saw it on the second watch, but I don't think we've seen it in any scene or any shot except for this one shot at this point in the episode. And that is she's in the 60s and Jamie, I think, is obviously in her happy place and he's reaching out to touch her face, her face. He's reaching out to touch her face. And behind her, we see a sunburst clock in the background. It's very 60s. It's very apropos of that time period. But not only is it time appropriate, period appropriate, it's also a sunburst. And that is very much, that is some beautiful shooting that they did, some beautiful set making. Because Jamie, many times in the books at least, is referred to, is a representation of the sun. There's that line in book, I think it was Dragonfly and Amber, when after she loses faith and then she basically hates him for a little bit, she goes off to her friend, I forget her name, she goes off to her friend's palace, castle to kind of recover. And Jamie comes to her.
Louise. Wasn't it Louise?
Louise de la Tour, something, yes. And she stays with Louise and Jamie comes to see her after he's gotten out of the Bastille. And she finally agrees to speak with him. And he's like, this came to my mind first. I could be wrong though, but anyway, I'll finish saying what I was saying. The line is...
Wasn't it in Versailles when they're in the garden, like he enters the garden and it was like the sun?
I don't know that it was in Versailles. Well, okay.
Peeked out of the sky.
It could have been wherever it happened. It was definitely outside. And the line is something along the lines of, and the sun came out in the person of, or Jamie came there. And when I looked up and looked out, I looked full in the face of the sun. That's the line, full in the face of the sun. And because Jamie was her son. And so them doing that, I thought was so beautiful. And I love that. I mean, unless you're a book reader, I don't think you'd get that because that, I don't think they, you know,
everything
they didn't use
from
her voiceover.
Is an Easter egg in the show now at this point. So
I'm just saying, I don't think you'd get it or... I think you could appreciate it, but I don't think you'd get it unless you had remembered that line. Only when he's telling her not to be afraid and he goes in to touch her. But this is only when he finally comes into her present does she leave her happy place. Now, okay, everyone's together. We're in the same timeline. She looks terrible, but is it bad that I was disappointed that her eye wasn't all swollen, like swollen shut?
It was, I mean, she had a Roger broken blood vessel eye.
Oh, fair enough.
I think that was enough. Because you're bypassing the entire battle scene where Ian throws a tomahawk in a dude's face. And then Roger kills a dude.
Oh, yeah. That like, was a bit.
Very skillfully, up close, kills a dude. And it clearly bothered him. And just like, it's just havoc. Like, straight up havoc where like, they are just, all the Ridge boys are just murdering them.
The Ridge Boys. That's their band. That's their band name. We're the Ridge Boys. Come see us. We kill it every week. Oh, gosh.
Myers plays the banjo. No, I'm lying. He doesn't play. He plays the jug.
Oh God, he does. I can't. That doesn't help. But anyway, he like says that to her, "You are alive. You are whole, Monia Dunn. Down, whatever." And when he asks her, "Do you know? Can you tell me who it was or who did it?" And just like in the book, when she can't identify the men who raped her, Jamie says the very famous line from the books:
"Kill them all."
Yes. Now, the sound
you
of
missed the big thing. You missed the big part of that whole. No, you missed the whole meaningful moment that happened before that. Okay. Because he's saying, they said there are some still alive, and they were like, and he goes, "She's bound by an oath. It's I that kills for her." And then Fergus says, "And me," and Ian goes, "Me too," and everyone's just like. It's like, I'm Spartacus.
That's true. That was a big moment. I forgot about that.
We all kill for her. And then there was who wasn't and how many. And then it's the kill them all. And then they didn't kill them all because they forgot to kill Lionel.
So the sound of them, of the men who weren't already dead being executed, it must. And probably the look, too, because they gave us a look at that. It must have reminded her of World War II. People being lined up and on their knees and executed, basically. It was very much a Claire thing, although obviously they weren't there in her 20th century. It reminded me very much of Video 2, unfortunately, in documentary. But, you know, images I've seen of people either at concentration camps or Jews being, you know, rounded up and kneeled down and shot in lines. It just full on reminded me of that. I'm not going to lie. And since she does talk about later on, she mentions the war she survived. I was like, oh, that's why I had that recall as well, or that callback. He wants her to see that they are dead. So she won't, not that she won't believe it, but that her body, her essence will not doubt. She will always, well, hopefully not forever.
She doesn't have to worry about any of those
anyone coming back. Exactly. So she will deal with what's happened to her. There's no escaping that. But she does not need, and he does not want her to have the added worry, anxiety of having to, you know, wonder if they're going to come back and finish the job, right? So he knows that she has enough to deal with surviving the abduction and the rape and the attack, all of it. He understands that. And so, number one, yes, it's revenge, but it's also for healing, quite honestly, so she can get on with her life and not always be looking over her shoulder. But of course, that's not always.
Yeah, we don't need another bonnet situation.
Well, okay, correct, except that they didn't tie off. They tied off as many loose ends as they could, but needfully. There's a loose end that was left very nicely by the show that we needed. So they go back to the Ridge with Lionel, who, as Summer said, was alive. And she's wrapped in the Outlander tartan. And Jamie tells her that Marsley and the baby, because she asks about them first, and he tells her that they're okay. And she tells him there was another TT there. And she doesn't tell him a lot.
I did not recall Marsley being that pregnant when Claire was abducted. Yeah. And then when they came back to the Ridge, I was like, Jesus, I don't remember her being that pregnant. Like, she was real pregnant.
She was real big. Yeah. And then she's like, am I imagining things or did I see Roger? And he's like, no, you didn't imagine it. They're back. Well, I'll tell you about it. They came home. When they get there, Bree greets her mom. Marsley comes out. And I wrote, now, this is, okay, it's way past this actual meaning of this question, the legitimacy of this question. But I'm asking it now kind of for funsies and for fun and also to be very sarcastic. So basically, Summer, what they're telling us is they're not doing the bugs, right?
Oh.
No, not in this scene.
they may find a way to weave it in later. I don't know.
Oh, gosh. So
the bugs were not present.
No, they weren't.
For the second half of the season. Bree helps Claire bathe, and she has a lovely moment where she calls back to after her rape when Lizzie says, "You have my hand and my ear if you want it."
Aw. I heard the lines. I didn't remember the callback. Oh, because it was what she said. Oh, yeah. No, after Bree.
Lizzie said that to her.
Oh, that gives me a tear prick. That's really nice. I didn't remember that from Bree's time.
How did
time.
I recognize that and you didn't?
I don't know. I was busy on the heaven side of things. What are you talking about? I was busy reading into the 60s. Goodness. Back to when the bath is done and Jamie is with Claire. Claire is with Jamie. He knows something akin to what she feels. Not exactly, because their experiences were not identical. But he, having been abused, not just beaten and, you know, tortured, but, you know, physically violated as well. I don't think he would say, "I know what it's like, Sasanak, and I'm just going to, like, I'm here for you if you ever need to talk about it," or whatever, which would have been, I think, not a bad thing to say. But I thought it was actually stronger for him not to say anything and just hold space for her when she kind of goes off and she's like, "You know, I survived a war. I did this. This is not," even though she kind of broke down a little bit, she was like, "This will not define me. This will not break me." And he comforts her, but he doesn't even say, "I understand, I've been there." And I thought that was good.
No, I know. But did you also notice that she had a list of things she's survived and she never once mentioned the word rape?
She couldn't. She couldn't say it. I will say this, and I don't think it's going to be a surprise. I don't think it's a spoiler, because y'all know that multiple rapes have happened now. I say it to the poor book readers, hear it all the time. So in book one, when Claire goes through, and in the show, when Claire goes through Crane's Mirror, right, goes through the witch trial, it is a lot worse in the book. I'll just tell you that way. It's a lot worse. The same thing happens, but she's stripped, not just the back, but the front. She is like tied to, again, another tree. What is it with them and trees? She's tied to a tree. She's beaten in front, like half naked in front of the town by the river. Like, they're going to dump her in the water. So it is a little bit different. I think it's a little bit worse, but whatever. She is so understandably shaken, and there's better words than that, but so traumatized, there we go, by that occurrence, that at least in the books, she, at least once a book, she, like, the word, you can Google it or look in Kindle if you have the ebook. The word Crane's Mirror is in more than one book. Even though it doesn't happen again, it is in her mind. It is traumatizing to her. It forms her character, obviously. So just like Crane's Mirror never leaves her, and the danger of being a woman of that time, especially a healer of that time and someone out of that time, and someone who's not afraid of men or doesn't act afraid enough, never leaves her. Just like that framed her, this is definitely a worse event than Crane's Mirror. Crane's Mirror could have ended up with her dead, which obviously is worse than this, but she didn't, so this one is worse.
Well, to be fair, this was going to end with her dead.
Oh, fair enough. You're right. Okay, fair enough. You're right. No, you're right.
He just saved her in time, just like he saved her in time at Crane's Mirror.
And that's why I said she was getting ready to go to heaven. Yes. You're right. I didn't think about that. You're correct. I think both would have, either on purpose or by just maltreatment, would have ended with her. That was what was going to happen. It was going to end with her dead and soon. In books, like, well, this is in book, well, again, they brought it forward. It's in book six, but let's pretend it happened in books. It happened in season six. So in book/season 1-5, Claire has, at least in the books, it's always like, "Oh my gosh, Crane's Mirror." It comes up at least once a book. The character, it is in her mind. It is in her mind, period. It never ends, understandably. Or it never leaves, understandably. After this, she has a lot. It's a lot. It's more traumatizing, I think. But it also makes her twitchy. It makes her, understandably, it takes time. So basically what I'm trying to say is we're going to see her suffer, or I guess heal is a better term, just like Brianna did. We're going to see her healing next season and, you know, God willing, future seasons.
I don't know. We'll see. Because you know what? Roger is not singing anymore, but he certainly can talk just fine.
Oh, Lord Summer. So anyhoozle, this is just as much a character building, unfortunately, bad character building, negative character building moment as Crane's Mirror was. But she survived. Thank goodness. So then we're with Roger and Bree. They get in bed and she turns out the light. She blows out the candle and he tells her it's kind of a confession, right? And he says, "I killed a man."
he asked her to blow out the candle because he said, will you listen if I tell you? And I don't have subtitles on, so I can't tell you the exact things he said, but that was the gist of it. And she's like, yeah, of course I'll listen. And he goes, can you blow out the candle? And then, you know, so that he could have his privacy. Confessional moment. Yeah. And it was such a confessional.
Oh yeah.
But he was just like, did your dad tell you what I did?
Yeah. Well, and fair enough. All we get though is I killed a man. And so, and we don't need any more. Yeah. We know that he's going to be telling her probably the details because it's a way for him to cleanse himself, to get it out of his head a little bit. The next morning, or the next scene at least, we're in the big house surgery and we're with Lionel and Marsley. Claire comes in and Claire is tempted by her hand hovering over the knife and grabbing it and then dropping it. She is tempted. And then I think this is where she sees the orange, right?
Mm-hmm.
She is tempted, but verbally promises not to hurt him.
Yeah, this is when in the 60s she not only sees it, we saw the orange multiple times, but this is when she picks it up and takes it and walks away. So that's her choosing. The only thing that ties the oranges to anything else is the stitches, which to me
she was choosing meaningful, her oath,
meaning that she was choosing the way of medicine as opposed to the way of revenge. Yeah.
Yes. And then she leaves and goes and in the hallway. I think it's outside of her bedroom. I could be wrong, but she collapses in a hallway on the stairwell. Oh my gosh, the stairs that never freaking ended. That was huge. It was huge, people. But yeah, she collapses in the hallway and...
Well, Ginger, a big house needs big stairs.
Is a big house. Yes, that's true. And she has her private cry breakdown here.
Yeah, I was like, despite her best efforts, she shattered a little.
She's going to lose it. Just a little. And then we are back with Marsley and Lionel. And Marsley says, he's like, could I have something to eat? And she's like, you'll get what you get and something else. And am I the only one who thought when she started with that, you'll take what you get, that she was going to finish with and you won't throw a fit?
That's very Lene.
And she did not, but Lene's, that's what I expected.
Lene's is you get what you get and you don't throw a fit. That is the yes, mantra.
That made me laugh so hard.
At dinner time at Lene's house.
And then Lionel takes Claire's role. Claire's usually the one doing this, but Lionel plays Cassandra. He says to Marsley, if you kill me, basically not just her, anyone, if he is harmed, right, further, if you kill me, my family will come and slaughter you and burn down your house from over your heads. And she's pretty much, she's like, I'm done. So
I said, Marsley is the hero we deserve. She's,
oh goodness.
She's like, because I was just now like, you saw she what needs she to kill put him.
In that water, right?
Yeah, the water root.
Huh.
I was like,
Hemlock, yes.
Yeah, I was like, she better kill him. I was like, somebody needs to murder him right away because if you don't, this is the problem with horror movies. If you don't make sure that the bad guy is dead, they always come back. So always make sure they're dead.
They come back. Yes. And then she preps her concoction and then sucks it up. There's a better scientific term, I'm sure. Pulls it up, sucks syringe. It up into the new glass condom syringe, and shoves it in his throat. Good griefus. And after she does it, he's dead. He's gone. And Jamie comes in. And he's like, oh, okay. Well, okay. I mean, it's good that he's dead. He was probably happy that he's dead, but oh Lord, there's going to be trouble. But he comforts Marsley, and I really like that. And it wasn't just like, oh, I understand it's hard. But Marsley had a really important moment there. She was like, I was so scared, and he has done all of these things to people that I love, to Mother Claire, to, he could have hurt my bairn. He could have hurt my son. He did hurt my husband, he killed Jordy, all these things. He cannot be allowed to continue breathing, slash if he is allowed to continue breathing and survive and heal, he will come back. She's basically saying what Summer is saying, right? That if I didn't take care of this, or someone didn't take care of this, he would be coming back,
right?
Or he would do more damage. I really liked that. And but it wasn't just her freaking out that she had done it, but she was like, she was physically scared. She did it in spite of her fear, because her fear, she's like, she told him, I'll see you in hell and da da da. But then she's with Jamie, she's like shaking. She's afraid. She's like, I am so, she's not sorry, but she's scared. She is scared that now she is damned to hell.
Hell was her secondary thought. Her first thought was, is he going to haunt me? She's like, is his ghost going to haunt me? Like, get your priorities, girl. Is his ghost going to haunt me? She's like, hell is for later, but haunting is for now.
Now Jamie's got a body. He takes the body back to Brownsville so his family can bury him. I did wonder.
Did you look at the legs?
Oh, yeah. It was really odd.
His legs looked real bad. Like, I wonder if they were, like, broken. Because we don't know how. I mean, he was definitely damaged in the battle. But I didn't see how they damaged him. And they had him tied to the table. So I couldn't tell how he was damaged on the table. But the body over Jamie's shoulders, the knees were going the wrong way.
It did
way.
Look a little awkward.
Like, the whole bottom, like, the calves were swinging in the wrong direction. I was like, well, that's not a good sign.
And he just dumped him on the ground. I was like, oh, Lord. Like, you're already bringing back his dead brother. At least, even if you don't want to, at least gently lay him down. He dropped in like a sack.
Nope.
Oh,
nope.
My gosh.
That is better than Lionel Brown deserved.
Doesn't matter about what he deserved. It's about keeping Frenzy with the family.
Bringing him back was more of a kindness than he deserved.
I agree with that.
And it wasn't just him. He wasn't the only Brown present. You have to send the message to the people. I'm almost positive that the Ridge Boys were outnumbered by the grouping of people, not even Brownsville. They were outnumbered by the people who kidnapped, the gang. So even outnumbered as they were, they killed them all. I know, I'm just saying, they killed them all. And here's the message. Not only did I kill them all, I have the balls to bring him back here and drop him down on the floor in front of you. You don't f*** with us. Don't f*** with the Ridge Boys.
The Ridge Boys. Now, Richard accepts what has happened, thanks him for bringing the body. And this is actually pretty, the biggest difference here, or between here and the book, is in the book, and I thought it was, I mean, I don't know why they didn't do it. It doesn't bother me so much, but I don't know why they didn't do it. But it doesn't matter. They just didn't do it. In the book, I thought it was almost more, I'll say more effective. It was more in your face. It was Jamie and Claire and a number of other people, probably Roger, probably most of the Ridge Boys. Whoever went to fight, who was still, they all lived. Whoever went to fight, joined them. They went to show strength in numbers, to bring back the body like they did in the show. But Claire, who, as Katrina is known for having like pearl white skin, right? Very, very, very fair. So all of her, like her eye was all like swollen up. They came really quickly. They brought the body to Brownsville really quickly, and they did it so that one of the reasons they did that was because they wanted to have proof, and not just the dead body proof, but proof that Claire had been harmed.
That doesn't have nearly the big energy of Jamie strolling in all by himself with the body.
But by them not seeing Claire, and I don't mean Richard so much, but by like the rest of Brownsville.
Oh, but you know what they did.
It's not about us.
They know what he did.
Well, we don't know because in the show, in the show, we don't know. In the book, we have a strong idea that this is not Richard's thing. He becomes involved now because his brother was killed. But he probably had an idea that Lionel was involved in some traveling wandering gang. Absolutely. But he was like, just dude, like, don't bring me into this. You know, don't keep your hands clean as far as like, don't get caught. But yeah, I agree. The effect of one person is just a different effect. But for the rest of Brownsville.
And he very clearly said, what's his name? What's
Richard.
The brother
Richard.
Is still alive. Richard says, Lionel reaped what he sowed and you did what you must. Long pause. As will I when the time comes. So, I mean, this we're seeing his evil villain origin story. We've just seen the origin story of Richard Brown, new supervillain of the Ridge.
So basically, do not forget the Browns.
Until you've literally killed them all. Until you've literally killed them all, you can't forget the Browns.
Oh, Lord. So they haven't killed them all. So back on the ridge, Roger and Bree are happy to be home. Claire is looking out at, they're bending over the railing on the big house, and she's next to Jamie, and she points out this crooked post and adds it to Jamie's honey-do list. And he's like, I can do that. She's like, no, tomorrow's fine. But she says, no, I want us to enjoy this ordinary day right now, because who knows how long peace will last. And that is that plus the storm coming, obviously is a huge call out to the coming revolution, right? And other problems to come, not just revolution, problems in general. Jamie quotes Thucydides, which I didn't write down. I just said that he quoted him. And there's more thunder in the distance, hearkening troubles to come. Their theme, the Jamie and Claire thing, comes up majorly. It comes up here. And normally it's kind of minory, but it comes up major. And when it's major, it's super happy and super, it's not just romantic. It is actually happy, because they don't get a lot of happy time, right? And I don't mean sex. I mean happy, lallybroc, idyllic, ridgy moments like this. But we get the line. So I said in a live after show a few episodes ago that they got the line right. No, the line is in this episode. So we got probably one of the most famous lines, and that is,
you want to say it? I may have written it down wrong, but it is, and this is a paraphrase for sure. If my last words are not I love you, you'll ken it's that I didn't have time.
You got it pretty much verbatim. When the day shall come that we do part, if my last words are not I love you, it's because I didn't have time. Oh, you'll know that's because that. And I noticed, it's not suddenly, it's the whole time they've been out there on the porch, but there's definitely a meaning to it. When she was tied up and covered in dirt and being, you know, beaten and raped and all those things, she was in whatever she was wearing before she was abducted, obviously. In her happy place in the 60s in heaven, whatever you want to call it, she was in scarlet red, right? Red shoes, red 60s beautiful kind of mini skirt dress.
And now she's in blue.
And now she's in all blue, like Madonna blue. Mm. And we don't get her blue powers because the show didn't go there.
She's clearly feeling better enough to complain about crooked posts. So
true. Now that night, it's later that night in bed, against the storm outside, they hold each other naked. And he tells her, you're a brave wee thing.
No, he says, Christ, you're a brave wee thing.
Yes. And then he asks her, how does she feel? And she says, safe. So I thought it was a very touching and strong ending, and sensitive and strong ending. I don't miss it as in, oh, I wish we had it. No, I was curious that they didn't have any smexy time with Jamie and the rattlesnake syringe.
Gross.
What? I didn't say I wanted it. I said I was curious. I noticed it missing. Saying, I remember these things.
You said it in such a way that it sounded like he was penetrating her with the syringe.
Oh, summer.
In a sexual way.
Oh, Lord.
So I'm just saying, just that weird. You need to look at how you say things sometimes. Your phrasing leaves a lot to be desired. So I have mixed feelings. Because.
About the ending or the episode?
No, I feel like the last episode, the one that Diana wrote, had such a cliffhangery ending that it felt like a season finale. At least an Outlander TV show season finale, right?
Got it.
Whereas this one felt, to be honest, more like a Diana Gabaldone book ending. Except
that's
for
interesting
not
that
the
you
one
say that.
But not the one with the bad cliffhanger ending. Almost all of them leave all of the characters in a safe place. Was it Echo if it's a really bad one?
Echo.
Breath of Snow and Ashes, it ends poor. Oh my God. Worst ending of a book. It was awful. And then we had to wait 5 years. But almost all of her books leave her characters in a safe place. Right? So last season, cliffhanger. I believe the season with the Myrta Fitzgibbons, you have to go and find and kill Fitzgibbons. And then, like, I don't remember what the season before was. But they all have tended to feel very ratings. Ratings, ratings, ratings. You have to end a season on a cliffhanger. You have to leave everyone wondering and they'll come back for more. And this felt like an honest Diana Gabaldon book ending, with the exception of Echo. where she leaves all of the people safe in a place you don't have to worry about them for a little while during Droughtlander. Because had they left us with last episode as the episode that is the end of the season, we would have all just been dreading what's coming. For God knows how long, because we don't even know when they're going to be able to start production again. Thanks, COVID.
So then I think, as fitting, there's no intro, right? There's no intro music, no intro scenery, which I think was very fitting. And outro-wise, it was just Rhea sings us out a cappella, which I thought it's the most gentle way of it. Well, actually, no, the most gentle would be, I was like, gentle. The strongest would be absolute silence, but it wasn't a tragedy they were ending on. They were ending on, I guess, hope and healing, or starting to have hope and healing. So it didn't warrant absolute silence. It definitely didn't warrant like the bonnet ending where you get a lot of dissonance and fear or dread. And I don't think it would have necessarily warranted instrumental. It could have warranted some instrumental music. I guess it could have even warranted, because of all the storm and the warning of the war to come. And even though they ended on a hopeful, sweet note together of healing and everything, I think because they're inside and you hear the storm outside, it would have not been inappropriate to have kind of a season two ending-ish.
But it rained the whole time. You heard the rain.
Oh, why is she saying? Okay, got it. Yeah. So you could have kept with the rain like you did. I mean, what they did, I thought was fine. But I think the another way that could have been done, I'm not saying it should have been, I'm just saying, like, what's another way to end it if it wasn't just her a cappella? Could have been like season two, if I'm not mistaken, or was it season three? I think it was season two. I think it was season three. Anyway, whichever one ended, the finale, where we had the first hint of those fifes, the fife and drum, because that is appropriate for right now. Even if it was just a little bit and just, you know, a hint of it, it would have been appropriate. But I think it was perfect the way they did it. I liked it. So it wasn't our shortest episode. Definitely not. It was about an hour and a half. So we'll see how much I edit out.
So guys, that was season five of Outlander, based upon basically the Fiery Cross book five and little bits of book six, which to remind you, we will be beginning our read along next week. So if you want to find out more about how to become a contributor for our read along, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/snow. That's SNOW. We have a sign up sheet on there that you can look at and see the available chapters that still have room for more contributors. And then you can message me and let me know which chapters you want me to slide you in for, and I will make it happen. And of course, if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, because you haven't talked about it enough yet, go to www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Again, a very special thanks to co-producer Aaron A. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon and find out what in the heck a co-producer is, or how to become one, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon. Again, thank you as always so much for listening. Sam, how do you feel now that we've finished our fifth round of episode discussions?
I'm exhausted, y'all. And I'm exhausted. There was a part of me that's like, ah, I can breathe. And then I'm like, no, I can't. The read-along starts next week.
Except that we have a lot more control over our read-along schedule than we do over an episode discussion schedule, because that's on Stars, or we have to base ours around Stars. And a lot of times, you know, that comes up with, like, oh, well, we're going to skip a week. And we didn't know until they announced it, right? So, yeah. So they both have their challenges and their wonderfulness. They're all wonderful, but they both have their high points and their challenges. But we are so tickled, especially since outside of book two, DIA, I Bred the Snow and Ashes, I think, is my favorite. It is crazy full. And so we really hope you join us. So thank you guys so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook,
facebook.com/OutlanderPod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at OutlanderPod.